What's happening? What's going on, y'all? Welcome back. Another episode of Write Like You Mean It, where we have been discussing narration. This is the fourth episode, and in this one, I want to talk about the elements of narrative and what we find in a prototypical narrative. We've kind of discussed some of this already, but I really want to go back and make sure that the structure we're standing on is solid, no warp in it, it's not cracked, and, you know, let's check our foundation before we continue to move forward. So we'll discuss four of these elements, and I'll get right into them right now. Quick side note, as you probably picked up on, I kind of love hate saying, I'm going to get right into it, let's get right into it. But dang it, if it isn't contagious, right? All right, time in. Did I say time out? Anyway, time in. Right, so the first element, which is really more of an explanation, is as follows. A prototypical narrative can be characterized as a representation that is situated in, which means must be interpreted in light of, situated in a specific discourse, context, or occasion for telling. So what does that mean? Well, it means that the telling of a story is done so in relation to a certain context, a certain stage setting, and the telling of it, how it's told, or the representation that we get through the narrative unfolds in relation to and as part of that very context. Basically, something happens somewhere and we're told about it. It marks the occasion for the telling, for the story. And often the writer of the narrative, and also embedded in the narrative too, so the narration itself, will use prior knowledge to construct meaning. So that's the first element. It's kind of like a tenet, really, a premise. Let's look at the second one now. So this representation, furthermore, cues interpreters or readers to draw inferences about a structured time course of particularized events. Fancy, fancy. The representation, furthermore, cues interpreters to draw inferences about a structured time course of particularized events. This means that the narrative may include information about events in a particular order, or it may not. It can be told, but it must include details that are relevant to each other and to all of these elements that we're discussing now. So everything has to work in relation to itself, or to everything else too, right? It all has to fit together and work together. That is really where the effect is generated, the synchronicity, if you will, of the happenings and the things that are said and the little details that are included. All of these synchronize to create an effect. And that synchrony happens through the movement of the narration from the beginning to the end, which again doesn't necessarily mean the first part of a chronological sequence. It could just be the chosen start point. And that's the beginning. It's the entry point, the initial point. And our initial entry doesn't necessarily have to line up with the chronological beginning of something. Our initial entry could be at the very end, and then we work backwards in like a reverse parallel fashion to find the end of the narration, which turns out to be the beginning of the story. So that's time, and time is fun. But I mean, honestly, time is one of the more fun things that you can play around with when you're telling a story. You use time to create tension, to create interest, for dramatic effect, or even to create the effect of mundaneness or everydayness. So to reiterate this element again, we're talking about the representation and what it does. So it cues interpreters, the representation cues interpreters, listeners, readers, people who are drawn into the narrative, cues them to draw inferences, to come to conclusions and make observations that engage them with the story, cues interpreters to draw inferences about a structured time course of particularized events, about what happens in the unfolding of the narrative across a certain ordering of time, an order of time. In any case, too, the details matter and contribute to the overall effect generated by the narrative, the telling of the story. Which brings us to the third element, which says that, in turn, these events are such that they introduce some sort of disruption or disequilibrium into a story world involving human or human-like agents. Whether that world is presented as actual or fictional, realistic or fantastic, remembered or dreamed, etc. So again, in turn, these events are such that they introduce some sort of disruption or disequilibrium. They throw things out of whack. There is an imbalance created in some story world involving people or agents of some sort. And the world that this happens in, the overall context, the stage, however you want to think about it, where this happens can be presented in all kinds of ways, as actual or fictional, as realistic or fantastic, remembered or dreamed, etc., etc. So what this means is that the story will include disruptions and unexpected changes in the events described that it describes. Constructing this story is a cognitive process. Remember that. As narrators understand and add details, they are responding to, but they're also altering the narrative situation that had been built before and that is still being built. So in other words, these events are experienced as disruption to people's lives or the agents within the story, and they cause changes in their perceptions of reality. And of course, the things that cause the changes don't necessarily have to be just events. They don't have to be the abstract thing that is an event. It can be a person and what's said by that person, something that person does, something that, you know, the narrator sees or witnesses or has brought to them in the form of conversation, dialogue from a certain character. For example, like Neo in The Matrix, you know, his normal life, he doesn't love it, but it's very much disrupted when Morpheus begins talking to him, conversing with him. And it happens maybe in a dream, maybe in reality, maybe both, The Matrix in short. But that disruption to Neo's life is what brings about his change in perception of reality. I think if you really look for this and start becoming accustomed to hearing the subtle and nuanced variations of it, you'll see it in everything, whether it be like an episode of New Girl, you know, a sitcom, or a story told on the nightly news, or some article you read about a new scientific discovery. It's almost always present. It's so core to the thing that is a story and the way stories are told through narration that once you begin seeing it, it's kind of like experiencing the sudden realization that, oh, red is a color, or fuchsia is a color, or aquamarine is a color. And then once you read that and realize it, it's embedded in your perception of reality, and you'll never not be able to not see it again. Well, there's a lot of negatives there, but, you know, I think you get the gist. All right, so before we get to the fourth point, let's backtrack a bit and very briefly, succinctly recap what we've said so far. So basically, something happens somewhere that brings about the occasion for the telling of the thing that happens. Then this representation, this thing that happens somewhere, has an audience and it cues them to read it in a certain way and to understand that it's happening in a certain order of time, with specific details that relate to each other, to the order of time that it's being told in, and to the overall story. They are part of the story, okay? And then these events and all the details that relate to one another turn on the introduction of some disruption into the world, in whatever way that world is presented, are used to keep the story going and to develop the changes and perceptions that occur along the way. All right, so that brings us to the fourth and final element here, which is the representation also conveys the experience of living through this story world that is shifting and moving, that is changing, and it highlights the pressure of events on real or imagined consciousnesses affected by those events. Thus, with one important provision, it can be argued that the art of writing a narrative, or the narrative art, is centrally concerned with something called qualia. Q-U-A-L-I-A. Qualia is a term used by philosophers of mind to refer to the sense of, quote, what it is like, end quote, for someone or something to have a particular experience. It's a term used by philosophers of mind to refer to the sense of what it is like for someone or something to have a particular experience. In other words, the central concern is with the quality of a character's experiences and emotions, at least when viewed from one particular perspective. So again, these events are experienced as disruptions to people's lives and cause changes in their perceptions of reality. And so the representation can be said to be centrally concerned with the consciousnesses of the characters involved in the story because those consciousnesses are affected by the disruptions and changes in the events of the story. And from there, we might even hypothesize that the representation must evoke in the reader the same emotions that the characters in the story feel in order for that genuine experience of character consciousness to be translated through the medium of text into the reader. And there is really where the fourth element, as we're discussing it, ends. But I should say, as a caveat to that last hypothesis, that claim, that an absolute capacity to evoke the experience of consciousness is not required of every narrative, at least not of every narrative in a verbal medium. This explanation remains valid for narrative broadly conceived, including for the nonverbal arts of painting and, well, the visual aspects of film anyway, as well as for fiction and other forms of narrative in which the experience of consciousness is often, though by no means always, front and center. Nonverbal examples of narrative art may focus on other aspects of narration. For instance, they may focus on the events, individual scenes, or the world of the story. Whether the narrative does indeed make consciousness a focal concern or not, its representation is intended to allow for the situation in some embodied interpreter, which can also be termed narrative embodiment. By this term is meant the process by which a reader or viewer or a listener or an observer in the case of a painting can become absorbed in the consciousnesses of characters in a narrative as they are suffering, experiencing, and coping with the disruptions and changes in the events described. Thus, in at least one sense, narrative representation can be thought of as qualia producing, or producing the sense of what it is like, as that which elicits narrative embodiment and thus narrative consciousness by means of narration, which is a process that may be part of a larger narrative art. In a somewhat different yet related sense, it can also be thought of as an inference machine or tool for inference, and thus also for narrative construction. This is mainly because it enables interpreters to infer a story world with the characters and events situated within it and their relations to each other across time and space. It also enables them to infer the experiences of those characters as well as the rules and laws of the world in which the story takes place. Such inferences about the world are, of course, drawn through comparison or the use of the interpreter's own memories, This means that the representation is, in an important sense, an insight into the interpreter's own conscious experience. They draw from what they know. I mean, you know, if we were to say this in a really basic way, we could say the likely case is that the writer writes from what they know. And if, for example, we're reading a passage and we find a character where the writer about the character has offered a description that conveys not only the character's experiential reality, just, you know, what's going on with them and what they're encountering, but also an insight into their conscious feelings and experiences, we can also look at this as like the writer is presenting experiences that are similar to their own. And maybe this passage turns out to be, in fact, a powerful example of narrative embodiment. The writer's own experiences are, in some sense, translated into the story of another person in the story world. In so doing, they enable a reader to imagine what it must be like to be this other character. And maybe, just also, what it might be like to be the person who created this character. You know, I think I just figured out the title for this episode. Here it is. Writing Like a Reader and Reading Like a Writer. So there we are, back to this crazy sounding, philosophically intense phrase, qualia producing. It's what it's like for the character, what it's like to be in the world of the character, and maybe what it's like to be the writer of the character and the world. And now, fittingly, I think we come full circle by saying, finally, the representation in question is intended to afford interpreters with some sense of how to integrate the different elements of narrative. For example, its characters, events, etc. How to integrate them into a coherent interpretation of a narrative construction. This work of interpretation involves the coordination of different kinds of knowledge, including that of, you know, psychology, epistemology, ethics, not only those and many others unnamed here, but also the ability to draw pragmatic inferences about the situated occasion of some telling or the art of writing a narrative. In other words, the representation must cue the reader to make inferences about how the different elements of the story fit together to create a coherent whole. It has to make sense. That's what this means. It has to make sense. It doesn't have to mean anything, but it should make sense. At least for a narrative representation that is to be thought of as a narrative representation. It must be interpreted as a representation of something that is, or was, or can be a story.